Real quick, who's Mikey? Thanks for the email. That's awesome.
Oh, excellent. Great, man. Thank you.
Second time.
Second.
The Connecticut one was... No.
We did it at the convention at the Mohegan Sun, and now this, so... You've been at all the screenings.
Yeah, after this is over, I know you guys set up somewhere at a table, but I got stuff I got to show you.
We don't, but we're here. We'll be cleaning up, and we'll probably hang around for a little bit.
I was speaking with Joe Staten at the New York Comic Con, and he said to me, he's like, you should be in that room. See, he knows I'm a collector of the art. I have quite
okay.
A bit
well,
of
we'll talk about that after the panel.
Yeah, definitely.
But, great,
I have stuff to show you.
So. Cool.
Very cool.
Anyway, this is the Charlton Comics movie panel. I'm assuming you're mostly familiar with Charlton Comics, which was a publisher that was in Derby, Connecticut, from about 1940 to 92 or 3 when they finally went permanently out of business. But between 1945 and 1985. Or six, they published comic books. And they published the most eclectic odd lot of comics from any publisher ever. They were cheap, they were chintzy, they were on the worst paper imaginable. You could actually see them beginning to deteriorate as they rolled off the press. They were just, But they were also some of the most fun comics ever published. It was overseen by management who didn't care what was in the books as long as it wasn't going to get them in trouble, and it could keep the printing presses rolling. That they were publishers that all they were interested in was keeping the presses rolling, getting the product out. They did their own printing. They did their own distribution. They had their own production in-house. They had a factory in Derby, Connecticut that had everything under one roof. From, like I say, from editorial to trucking, and they were just this weird little company. And Steve Ditko worked for them, and Jim Aparo worked for them, and Denny O'Neill worked for them, and Dick Giordano worked for them, and John Byrne worked for them, and Joe Staten, and the list goes on, and even includes me, but which I should introduce us so you'll know who me is. Me is Paul Kupperberg. I'm a writer for comics. I've been doing it for a few years for DC, Marvel, Charlton, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have Keith Larson, who is a producer of Charlton movie, and Jackie Zabuska. Did I get that right?
You did it right. You did good.
Who is also another producer on the movie. They are co-producing the movie. The movie actually got its start 2 years ago at the Connecticut.
One year ago.
Yeah. In August. 1 year ago, August. Oh, sure. Thank you.
Yeah.
When Keith and Jackie wandered into a panel I was doing about Charlton with Denny O'Neill.
That might be the one you're confusing it with.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
It was a Charlton.
Right. It was. Right. I had. We were there with Denny O'Neill and Bob Layton and Jose Luis Garcia Lopez and
Frank.
And Frank McLaughlin, and these guys were just tired and resting their feet.
Well, partially true. I saw your names on the thing, and I said to Jack, "Oh, I grew up reading these guys. Let's go. They'll probably talk about Batman and Iron Man and all this stuff."
And then they didn't. So we didn't know what the hell we were getting ourselves into.
But rather than wandered out, they actually found themselves being sucked into the story, which is a fascinating one. This was a company that was started by two guys who met in jail. One was there for a political corruption charge, and the other was there for a copyright infringement, which was actually a jailable offense in those days. They met in jail. They took to each other. They started a partnership and formed Charlton Comics afterwards. And they bought these old printing presses that were used for printing cereal boxes and the like and adapted them to print comic books and did everything on the cheap and were probably hooked up to organized crime in some way right through to the end. And I even visited the house of one of the publishers. There was an estate sale at the house of John Santangelo, who was one of those jailbirds. And they owned that town. Jackie is doing research, and it's what did the city clerk or the historical society?
When they realized that we were digging about Charlton, and she goes, "That was run by San Angelo, and we were very enthusiastically saying, oh, yes, it is. Do you know about him? And she recoiled, gave us the oddest look, and said, yeah, we know about them. And that seems to be the general consensus when you ask about them around town.
So there's this fascinating backstory that, you know, we all knew Charlton was cheap. We all knew Charlton was you know, started by guys who met in jail. But there's obviously way more going on beneath the surface than anybody has been aware of. And even now, Jackie is digging and finding...
lots of dirt.
Lots of dirt, and probably dirt that won't even be usable because...
mainly because of mafia ties. Those are no joke.
Yeah. So...
I think what's cool about the project from, you know, probably speaking for Jackie, our perspective is we kind of went in cold, heard this story within, you know, an hour encapsulation. We're inspired enough to try to do this, and now we're thinking when we're done with this, we'll be the one of the definitive, you know, go-tos for information on Charlton, because there's not much out there. It's really hard to find.
No, if you quickly Google it, you're going to get the same story, and a lot of the facts and the dates are skewed, outright wrong. So it's going to be great to finally put the true history out there so it can sit alongside Marvel and DC and Image in terms of start and finish.
Has everyone seen the trailer? Should we run the trailer just to kind of warm up the room?
Yeah.
Hopefully this is up loud enough.
Charlton was absolutely essential. If I hadn't gone out to see Charlton, then none of the rest would have happened the way it did.
They gave me work when I didn't have it.
That's where it all began, in Charlton.
The beauty of Charlton is everything is done under the same roof.
Management there was questionable at times at best.
I think this is a matter of right hand not talking to the left hand.
These two gentlemen met in jail.
They put together this company called Charlton because both of them had a son named Charles.
And then when they got out, they started publishing.
At one point, they actually did have to move the comics operation into a bowling alley.
Suddenly, you hear a strike and somebody going, yeah!
Trouble was a sidewater of a sidewater. They were out there doing their thing, and nobody was paying any attention.
And then there was Charlton that was producing what seemed to be kind of off-brand. I couldn't quite tell what they were doing.
Charlton was just a hodgepodge of weird titles.
It was the three-legged dog of the comics.
Guys were free to do really whatever they wanted within the boundaries of good taste in the comics code.
C-A-T-A-P. Yes, cheap. They were cheap.
Hell yes, they're cheap.
John threw nickels around like they were manhole covers. He was the cheapest guy you ever met.
What they needed was carbon-based life forms who knew how to type.
I don't know how much I should be saying about this.
Charlton was selling some of their characters to multiple people. Yeah. That's kind of funny. Well, I'd be willing to confess to a felony on camera. Sure.
The printing press that they had was used to print cereal boxes, which is a whole different process altogether.
Printing was horrible. Paper was much lower quality than anybody else was using.
You could smell them beginning to decay even as they were rolling off the presses. Or you'd pick up a comic book and the wrong insides would be in the cover.
They decided to shred tons of archival comic book pages.
Somebody just throwing out these original pages because they couldn't possibly conceive of them being valuable.
Beautiful artwork. They laid on the floor for the guy painting the seal didn't drip paint on the floor.
And if it was a bad snowy day, they would throw them down on the floor so it would absorb all the slush.
It's something out of a sitcom, which I suppose is why you're making this documentary.
Charlton has its place and deserves to be remembered.
The Charlton guys were the new guys on the block, trying really hard.
I just happened to be there at the right place at the right time. There was a creative, powerful force that lived in Charlton Comics, and it was producing top-quality work.
I loved working for Charlton. I could have used more money.
It was the people from Charlton that added juice to DC Comics.
They gave it to the comic book industry a lot of good characters.
There wouldn't be a Watchmen if it wasn't for the Charlton characters.
I think Charlton should be proud of the stuff they put out.
It showed in the work. I mean, some people were busting their butts, and because that was amazing stuff.
I'm perfectly willing to say sometimes you really do win the lottery, and I did.
Tip of the iceberg, my friends. And I don't know if you're aware of it. And if you're not, please pick up a postcard and check it out. There's an Indiegogo campaign running for the film right now. For another week. And, you know, all the help we can get is appreciated and needed. You've seen who they've already talked to. I mean, you know,
And that's just scratching the surface.
So once you know the funding is in place and they can travel and get to all the people they want to interview, is going to be a pretty comprehensive and, you know, fully, like, if you were if you're alive and were working for Charlton Comics, they want to talk to you. Mm-hmm. This is going to be intense.
What's great about contributing is, like, you're not only donating to the film and helping us finish it, there are great prize packs, but more importantly, you're going to be with us every step of the way during the rest of the filming and post-production. We're going to need an audience to show what we're doing to make sure that it's still interesting to all of you. So by contributing, you'll still be in the loop. We're not going to forget about you. We do want your money, but we're still going to be your friend later. You know, after you give it to us.
And ultimately, this documentary will also go to benefit the Heroes Initiative, which is an organization that helps comic book creators in need.
That was part of the impetus. It was the next day after we went to that panel. I was home and kind of going through things, and there was a brochure I'd taken from Denny O'Neill about the Hero Initiative, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, I wish I could give more than, like, $50. I'd rather do something more generous. And I went over, and I was actually washing dishes and replaying the panel in my head, and I went, oh, my God, duh. So I, soapy fingers, I call Jackie, and I'm like, what do you think of this idea? And we raced back down and just cold-pitched these guys, and that's how it happened. I mean, as simple as that.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know there was enough of a Charlton centric group there, you know, with Denny and all that the interest was definitely there. These guys, as you can see, Denny was, you know, loved his time at Charlton. I worked for them for about 6 months or so. I sold them a bunch of stories before I started selling to DC, who paid three times the page rate. So as I could continue writing for Charlton or not. So I didn't, which I regret now. But it was a lot of fun. You could just pretty much, yeah, come up with an idea for a story, you throw them a line about it, and they go, yeah, sure. You know, there was nobody breathing down your back, nobody taking creative decisions out of your hands. It was a fun place to work.
Yeah, and, you know, the film, going back to the trailer, so the idea was originally, first, we have to gain confidence from these guys. I mean, we walk up to Paul and Bob Layton and Denny and TC at this show and tell them, and they're like, yeah. And we spent the better part of a year. Jackie and I immediately strategized, like, we have to get some home runs here. We have to get some of the Mount Rushmore recognizable, you know, talent in this trailer. We can't just get a couple of people who are local that work there or just put together a trailer of pictures of their comic books and just said, this is what happened at Charlton. We knew we had to get those faces. So we sat down and we meticulously mapped out, we found where they all lived. And once we realized there were some of them right within a 2 to 3 hour driving radius, we set out to find them all. And Paul, we met with Paul first. We took him to dinner and, you know, will you help
buy me food now? Like, I'm in on any project. Pizza? Sure, I'm there. Yeah.
Will you help us start, you know, pulling these guys in? Joe Staton was the first one we went to visit. Mm-hmm. We spent the day with him and his wife, and Joe helped us get Joe Sinnott. That's when we first backtrack a little bit.
Bob Layton was one of our most enthusiastic guys that we talked to at the Connecticut show, and we wanted to go out to LA and do his full interview, but it just didn't pan out, and we found out he was coming to Massachusetts. So we said, we're going to come up to this show, and it was this rinky-dink Comic-Con in a hotel. And
anybody been to Super Awesome Mega Fest?
It's small.
It's not super awesome or mega.
Mm-mm.
But it's a fest.
It's a fest.
So we show up, and we have all our equipment, and Bob then realizes this is a legit interview. You guys are not fanboying me and just trying to be buddies. And as we're setting up equipment, he gets up, and he goes over to Joe Sinnott, who's across the room, and Joe Staton, and said, have you talked to these guys? And both of them were like, no. Who are they and what do they want? And so Bob Layton, man who saved Iron Man, is pitching us. And that was the first step in getting the two Joes on board.
Right.
We went to Joe's.
We shot all three that day, but it was in this cruddy hotel ballroom and the lighting was bad. We kept Bob's because obviously he's across the country. But then we found out that the two Joes live 20 minutes apart up in the Saugerties area. So we got hold of Joe Staten first, went and did the day with him. We were supposed to see Joe Sinnott the same day, but
there wasn't enough time. It's, I mean, these interviews, they take hours, because as much as any of the guys who worked at Charlton said, yeah, I can talk a little bit about it, once you get them going, all the memories start flooding out, and 3 hours later, you've got this mountain of gold.
It's incredible, yeah. So, actually, I have a clip here. I put together some, like I said before, some exclusive Rhode Island Comic-Con stuff that won't go online, and some might make the final cut. We don't know. You know, we don't know until we get there. But I went through some interviews and clipped out some stuff I thought might be a little interesting, and here's one from our shoot with Joe Staten that I like. It's the part where he says, you guys are doing this all wrong.
So. Everyone's a critic.
Where's the audio? Yeah,
would occasionally steal material to get back to me. So I have some of my ghost stories, and I have the...
There were a lot of distractions this day by birds and traffic and fire engines. Line.
So they didn't particularly care what happened to the originals. So it's good that Bob and Nick and others would occasionally account for something.
So was it hard to build a portfolio for yourself if you couldn't get your own original stuff back?
Yeah. It was. Could be a problem. Yeah.
Good voices.
I think that's the mailman. That was the mailman.
You know, what's kind of funny, actually, is if there's background distractions, that kind of goes with it. The whole idea is that the books were shabby.
That's right.
So let's make a production value shabby.
That's right. You know, for this to be a proper filmed version of the Charlton story, you should have all your color values just slightly off and out of focus, and
make it a movie.
And occasionally
about Marvel.
The sound should just cut out for no reason. So that's what you should be going
bad
for.
Bad edits,
right?
Black holes.
Right.
At one point during the movie, we insert like a Japanese cartoon.
We had fun with that. That
certainly,
day, we were
Nick,
plagued with distractions. It was constant, that interview. It's
yeah.
Just fire engines and garbage trucks outside and people yelling.
And
we were out
mailman.
On his porch, and it just got crazy. So from there, we just moved right on, and we started getting these guys. And I think we got more than we thought we would.
Yeah, it turns out that with every interview that we do, they'll ask us, like when we were at Denny O'Neill's house, he's like, have you talked to Steve Skates? And I'm like, yeah, he's my Facebook friend now. He added me, and he goes, how's he doing? And I'm like, well, great. Why haven't you seen him? And he's like, no, I haven't. He's like, but would you like his phone number so you can call him? And I'm like, sure. And that's how it's been working. These guys are more than willing to help us out. And so with every interview, they're like, have you talked to? And they'll give us a list. And we'll say no, because we're not that far along, and then they'll give us contact information.
What else is funny about it is they haven't seen each other in a long time, which gave us the idea, and we put it into our Indiegogo campaign to have this cocktail party at the screening, the first screening, and get all these guys back in one room, quite possibly for the last time ever together, which we think would be really kind of fun. So, you know, the quicker we can get this done, obviously, the quicker that'll happen. So... You know, this is the dog chasing its tail here. You know, we're going to get it done. If we have to keep doing it ourselves, it's going to take a long time. With some financing in place, we can crank through it and get it shot quickly and then get into post. So
it's a passion project.
It's a passion project, and I keep reminding myself, and the two of us remind each other a lot, let's just enjoy this journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're never going on it again. And it's really been, for me, growing up reading these guys, and I originally wanted to draw comics when I was in high school. That's all I wanted to do, and guidance counselors and lack of support kind of discouraged me from doing that, so I ended up doing this. Close, right? And now here I am, 30
time.
Years later, working with the guys I dreamed of working with, but in my medium. It's
and
kind
me.
Of fun. And Paul.
And Paul.
So that's the added bonus, right? So yeah, it's been fun. So, you know, we keep going. We're using the phrase "up and Adam" now. I know it's borrowed from The Simpsons, but Captain Adam is a famous Charlton character, now DC property. So we're using "up and Adam."
And you know, there's A lot of interest, there's a growing interest in Charlton of all forms. This all started the kind of Charlton mini revival that we're facing in our own little heads here, it started on a Facebook page. A guy named Fester Faceplant. his real name is Mark Knox, but he called himself Fester Faceplant. Started a Charlton fan page, and he has a Charlton blog, and he's very very into it. Collects them and I joined the Facebook page at some point, because I'm a fan of this stuff, and a few other people were on it as well who had worked for Charlton. And at some point, somebody made a joke about we have enough talent on here to do our own fanzine. So I kind of said, sure, if you do a fanzine, I'll write a story. And then other people started jumping in, and suddenly we had this whole project going.
Your bag's over here.
Yeah. And... what started as...
Where'd
you hide them?
Are they in this box here?
Hmm?
Are they in this box?
No, that's not mine.
Oh, I thought this was yours. That's mine. Please bear with us when we bring this to a screeching halt.
See, it's very Charlton-esque.
It's right behind me.
It's disorganized. And...
right. And we have no idea what we're doing.
It's great.
And we'll see what happens and then put it out. but anyway, it led to... the Charlton Arrow, which we started publishing, and we have been, we've been getting work from people ranging from, Joe Staten and Nick Cuddy to Rick Burchett and I got to read
Roger.
Names.
Roger.
Yeah, we got Jim Aparo, Pat Boyette, Sandy Carruthers, Roger McKenzie, Mort Todd, Neil Vokes. In here, there's another title we did, Paul Kupperberg's Secret Romances. No, not really. And then we have Unusual Suspects. We have a Western title. Anyway, what started really as a joke on a Facebook page suddenly turned into a little self-publishing thing that Mort Todd, Roger McKenzie, and I are doing together. And we have several titles, and we're trying to do more. And we have a website. We do online comics as well that we then package and publish. But, this all started really as a joke. And now I've got my own little, comic book publishing company, which is pretty cool after 40 years.
And we have a little movie that also kind of started as a joke.
As a joke. It was like, so we were all just kind of fans hanging around and meeting other fans and going, hey, So it really, whereas Facebook is really a living hell.
Hey, we've gotten most of our contributions off of Facebook.
She does the
phone. Yeah. But, Facebook is where reason and sanity goes to die. That's despite that, there are, you can find kindred spirits there, and never, I swear to you, when I volunteered to write a story, I thought it was going to be, we'd do a cheap little fanzine, we'd have fun, and go our separate ways. And suddenly we've got, a publishing schedule. And again, these guys stopped in to listen to a panel, and we've got a major motion picture.
So, yeah, it's all dovetailing together, which is great, because with the momentum they're building and what we're trying to attach to it is all serendipitous timing.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the rumors about the Blue Beetle movie, it's all coming. It's like suddenly Charlton is popping up. Maybe in the DC form, but it's still coming back, because when someone hears about the Blue Beetle, if they don't read comic books, they're going to look, they're going to see DC, then they'll hit the Wikipedia page, trace it back to Charlton, which brings it back to us. So I think the timing is quite kismet. It's a little scary and really convenient, but...
and we're also finding things that people who don't like... I don't want to put... have not... favored doing interviews or conventions or these things lately, somehow weaken when we mention the Charlton thing to them. Neil Adams being one.
I didn't think you'd get Neil. I thought,
we couldn't shut him up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have a clip here we can play of Neil, something, a really good story about ping pong.
Ping pong balls? I thought you said King Kong balls. Okay, never mind.
Well, that's up to Neil. And John Byrne being another one, where
we're working on it.
We're favor, you know, we think we can weaken him too. And I don't know, do you want to mention what you did 2 weeks ago?
Hey, why not? You guys were here for us, so we'll share the story. So we had a panel at the Mohegan Sun Convention Center for Terrificon, Connecticut's Comic-Con. And there I met Mort Todd, who is heading up the Charlton Neo project. And I told him that even though everybody says I'll never get Steve Ditko, I said, I'm getting him. I don't care what anybody says. He's not saying no. I'm going to get him in some capacity. And through telling Mort the story, he goes, well, he's involved with Neo now. We're going to be putting out a Steve Ditko book as part of Charlton Neo, and I have to send him proofs of everything in the mail. I send it through UPS, or I could UPS it to you, and you could deliver it. So I said, absolutely. So a little less than a month ago, I got the books from Mort. I headed off to New York, and I knocked on his door, and thankfully he doesn't have a peephole, so he has to literally open the door, and there in front of me is Steve Ditko in the flesh. And of course he gives me the look like, who the hell are you? Why are you at my doorstep? And I said, I have a package from Mort Todd. And he kind of glances, and I go, it's your comic books, the Charlton Neo project. And when I said the word Charlton Neo, he, like a five-year-old with a fresh comic book, he reached out for it, and I handed him the package, and he opened it, and he's like, oh, thank you so much for bringing this. And I introduced who I was and what I was doing, and I said, I'm a filmmaker doing a documentary about Charlton. And he doesn't like cameras, so he didn't back off, but he was listening cautiously. And I said, I know you don't like to do on-camera interviews or interviews at all, but I need help getting my facts straight. There's a lot of stuff that I can't find. I'm digging it up on my own. The Historical Society is only so much help, and finding these guys is a lot of trouble, but you were at the factory for a good chunk of time. You know what went on there. I need your help. And when I said the factory and I said Charlton, he softened quite a bit, and he goes, you know what? Let's start talking through the mail. He goes, write me a letter. So I sent him off a letter, told him who I talked to, what I need for him, questions, and so we're going to go from there, but he's up to talking. And so
even if he's, you know, even if he's just deep background guy, that's still, I think,
he's
way closer.
To talk.
It's more than anybody's gotten in over 40 years out of him. Yeah. And I just want to say, as a kid who, like, gravitated to Spider-Man first, I was really jealous that she got to do that.
It was pretty fucking sweet. He shook my hand.
I met him once when I was on staff at DC. I asked him to do a backup for New Gods. When Walt Simonson was taking over New Gods, we were scheduling a whole bunch of backups to for the book. So Mark Miller wrote a story, and he asked if I could get Steve Ditko to draw it. So, yeah, I can always make the call. So I called him. He said, sure. And I said, I can send you this stuff. He said, no, I'll drop by. I'll come over. So, yeah, I actually had Steve Ditko in my office, sitting in my chair. Yeah, you know, and
I hate you now too.
And he, but it's like no matter what I did, you know. Oh, you know, you drew one of my earliest stories at Charlton. You know, he's like, oh, really? That's nice. So the script, it's like, you know, he no interest in the past whatsoever. It's like it was killing me. But at least I got to meet him, you know, and I got to talk to him, and his ass print was in my office chair.
Did you make a mold of it?
There had been some other people, you know, so I had to...
I do find it funny, by the way, when these guys gush over each other. That's kind of funny.
It's really funny. They geek out of each other all the time. It's
great. You saw me.
Oh, yeah.
I'm walking over to, like, Ken Bald and going...
Just today.
Yeah.
We're walking around downstairs.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a 60-year-old man going up to a 95-year-old man and going, I love you. You were great. You drew these comics. And he's sitting there going, yes, of course, I know my boy. You know? So, but it's cool. I love these. He thanked me for coming over to say hello to him. And I thanked him because, you know, he gave me so much. You know, I mean, I grew up on his stuff. And I feel this way about all these guys. I feel this way about... You know, Steve Ditko, I feel this way about Neil Adams. And you know, the fact that I got to meet a lot of these guys was just icing on the cake. It would have been so cool just to be, like, you know, a fan and then to get to know them, you know. Like, Neil Adams would refer to me as the not annoying Kupperberg brother. Now, how cool is that, you know?
Well, since we're talking about Neil, I have a quick little clip. Probably won't be able to squeeze it into the movie, but it's really entertaining. Dick Giordano was a huge part of Charlton, of course, and he's no longer here with us. So we're digging into a lot of people who were personal, really tight with Dick. So we asked Neil, what was he like? And this is what we got.
Now, I got to say this. Anybody you talk to about Dick Giordano is going to say nice things. It's just the way it is, okay? Because there's some guys that are around that are nice guys, okay? Now, I think of myself as a nice guy. I'm not as nice as Dick. It's just, you know, you just can't do that. You know, there's some guys that are nicer than other people. Dick was nicer than me. And everybody will tell you that. But I will tell you a little secret. I don't think that Dick Giordano was such a nice guy. And I will tell you why. He invited me and my family to his house one weekend. We played baseball. We had a good time. The families enjoyed the families. But I noticed when we walked in that he had a ping pong table right out front in the foyer. So I said, oh, a ping pong table. And Dick said, yeah, would you like to play? I said, I haven't played ping pong in a long time. He said, yeah, I haven't played ping pong in a long time either. But you know what? We can do it if you want to. I said, well, how long has it been since you played? He said, years, years. I said, well, I haven't played in years either. But I guess I could pick it up. So I'm thinking, well, he hasn't played it in years. I haven't played it in years, but I was a pretty good ping pong player. So I said, after dinner, you know, that'd be great, right? So after dinner, hey, let's play ping pong. Turn the lights on, move the chairs back, start to play ping pong, okay? We're about even, okay, and then he beat me. Okay, we'll see what I can do in a second game. We'll do a second game, okay? We play a second game, I'm doing fine, and then he beat me again. Now, I got to do one more game, because he beat me two games, you know, I got to get something out of this. So we play a third game, and sure enough, he beat me again. Now, in my opinion, if you got a guest at your house, and you're playing ping pong, you could let him win once in three games. I mean, really, you know, I think that's the right thing to do. He could have faked it and let me win one, but he didn't. So I'm not so sure Dick is such a great guy.
So this coming from a guy we were told we couldn't get, would probably charge us money to do an interview.
And would be surly when he did it.
And told us, I don't know, I could talk for maybe 5 minutes. I wasn't there very long. And that's what started to happen. Yeah. So.
Yeah. There's the Charlton, there were a couple of those little, you know, Dell comics, even though that was more corporate, you know, that had this Dell publishing behind it. They were still kind of these cheap, chintzy little comics that fans in the 60s, 50s and 60s loved. You know, there was just something, they were so, you know, uncorporate. DC, like, you know, when I worked at DC, people say, oh, it must be so much fun to work at DC. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of like an insurance office with cooler stuff on the wall, you know? it really was. I mean, you know, it's a business. Marvel, not so much. I mean, I never worked much at Marvel, but I understand there was much more hilarity there than in the halls of DC. But even still, you're a corporation, there's a certain level of decorum that's expected, and you didn't get the feeling that that was ever a problem at Charlton, because, you know, they publish comics in a bowling alley. So, you know.
About the facility, and this is part of the tragedy of the story, because, as Paul can tell you, these other companies, you know, you produce the comic in the offices, or it's, you know, I guess all the elements come together at the office.
Right.
A lot of people working from home or what have you.
And then
it's got to go to a printer.
Right.
And then it's got to go to a distributor.
First it's got to go to a separator,
right.
Then it's got to go to the printer, then it's got to go to the distributor, and then it's got to go to the sub-distributors, yada, yada, yada.
They had it all right there.
Mm-hmm.
All of it. Soup to nuts. They had trucks in the back, and they did everything. And they had how many, 30, 35, 40 major comic book talents under their roof and didn't know,
mm-hmm.
it, because they just didn't care. And, well, the physical plant is something, and TC has a good bit about that, too. But Frank McLaughlin's soundbite here is actually pretty cool when it talks about the fact that the comic books were just there to keep the presses running all the time. because it would cost them more money to shut the presses down. They were concerned about magazines. That's all they cared about. They were printing Hit Parader
and their puzzle magazines.
And the crossword puzzles and all
that
kind of stuff.
That's what was making the money for them.
Right. So here they have all these amazing talents under there. And that's why they had the freedom they did. And Frank actually explains it really well in this soundbite. Again, these are raw, unedited clips just pulled from the interviews.
The chocolate factory?
Well, it was strange. Like I say, everything was under the same roof. When you walked in the front door, there was a big room with maybe half a dozen desks. And on the right-hand side, when you first come in, was San Angelo's private office. And never came upstairs where the artists were. I could count on one hand the times I've seen him up there, and it wasn't to deal with the artists. One time he brought somebody through, and he couldn't introduce the guy to any of the artists because he didn't know our names. And we have been there, some guys have been there 10 years. He didn't know anybody's name. These are our artists. And the guy shakes hands. And it was strange because he was introduced with a Spanish name, but he had a German accent. So he was in and out in a couple of minutes. And come to find out, this guy was Adolf Eichmann's son. And he flew into New York. Somebody picked him up at the plane. Did you hear the story before? I picked him up at the plane, took him back up to Charlton. Okay. And the guy had a German accent, but he's got a Spanish name. Joe Gill had a magazine in his desk with his father's picture on the cover. And when he left, which St. Angelo, Joe said, "Hey, I'll bet you this is this guy's son." Sure enough. But he was gone from the building in no time. He was in and out of Derby in about an hour, back on a plane, heading back from where he came from. A true story. That's one of the very few times I ever saw John upstairs where the artists were.
To bring the son of the Nazi guy who organized the Holocaust.
Right.
Wow.
That's what we're dealing
That's
with.
That's the kind of stuff we're getting. And
why was he there for an hour? What possible reason would bring him to Derby freaking
Probably
tonight?
The same possible thing Jackie...
Yes, alludes to. Yes.
Well, Jackie got a call from this guy who said, "My dad was the chief financial officer."
No, he doesn't say that. He emails me and he goes, "You need to talk to me. I know everything." That's the email, and I said, "Okay, great, you know everything." So I give him a call. We play phone tag. We now call him Mobster Steve.
Mobster Steve.
He goes...
He looks like... You guys know what John Romita Jr. looks like? He looks a lot like John Romita Jr. with white hair.
Yeah.
Just, you know, hey, sit down. Hey, come on.
Johnny's a nice boy from Brooklyn, you know?
Like him, too. So.
His father was the chief financial officer, without an accounting degree, by the way. He got his accounting degree.
And everything was cash. That's the way they did it back then. It was cash for everything.
And it was great talking to him because he would be telling us stories about what was ongoing at Charlton, such as they had an outlet up in Toronto, which I never heard about, but the truck would do runs every 2 days. Now, they're publishing magazines and crossword puzzles and comic books, but there's no way a truck needs to go up to Toronto every 2 days. Factory right over the border.
That's not accounted for anywhere.
That's not accounted for anywhere that we can't find, but it's going up there every 2 days.
Huh. Or my other favorite story was... Mr. John would go to Italy to get people to work in the factory, and he'd bring his Cadillac to Italy, and then he'd
Cadillacs.
Then he'd have it brought back and sell them the next day. I don't understand why bring them back if you're going to sell them the next day, huh?
I checked everywhere but the rocker panels.
John also made sure he had enough money so he'd die of natural causes.
That's right. Paid, made sure he would not be murdered.
And you know, this. As sleazy as Martin Goodman was, as sleazy as, you know, the guys who started DC were, you know, they were doing the equivalent of pornography.
Charlton had porn too.
Oh, sure.
Straight and gay.
Yeah. And they also published paperback books, you know, both regular, you know, mom and pop, you know, anybody can read, and these men's stories, you know, these men's novels.
And inker Vinnie Coletta, many people might recognize that name, was the staff photographer for the softcore porn.
Yeah.
That they would shoot in a little room in the back of the factory.
Or even outside.
Yeah.
Or in Dick Giordano's room. when he'd passed.
And when Vinny was in D.C. Anyway. You know, these stories are nowhere else. No other I have never heard. You know, and again, I've been a fan and kind of a, you know, an amateur historian on comics for 50 years. And I am hearing things that I had no inkling of, you know. And I've heard, you know, I grew up with Paul Levitz. You know, we published fanzines together in you know, 1971. So I kind of sometimes hear what goes on behind the scenes at, you know, publishing companies. Ain't never heard none of these. Nothing.
No, it just keeps getting better for us.
Yeah.
You have something?
Nope, go
okay,
for it.
I was just going to roll this quick little TC. This kind of echoes in a way, or talks about the physical layout of the plant, but it's just a funny little anecdote that I, you know, I like how...
Well, at that particular point in time, things were kind of wound down. It wasn't...
he was there at the end.
Well, my first published work was... years earlier, at Charlton, and at that point they did have a bullpen. It was a small one. It was basically George Wildman and another gentleman, Bill Pearson, and then the coloring staff, and that was pretty much about it. None of that existed when I was there to edit, because I had all my people working separately, and then I just brought everything in. But it was kind of quiet, and it was funny because you would come into the main doors. And everything for Charlton was off to the left as you came into the main door. And you could see everybody. And it's like, hey, you know, like, but they still wanted you to talk to the secretary at the front and say, oh, this is, you know, I'm TC here to see Bill Pearson. And, you know, it was just kind of weird. Like, he's right there. Can I just walk right over? You know. It was interesting to watch the colorists work as well. So that was fun. And then, you know, taking the tour of the place, because the entire factory was, you know, soup to nuts. Editorial was in front, and then they had the printing presses, and they had the shippers in the back, and the trucks, and, you know, but it was literally, you know, you start one end of the building, walk all the way down.
Yeah, and the funny part about the building is, like, if you look online, it says it was approximately 150,000 square feet, and we found out, talking through Town Hall, it's actually 200,000 square feet. So it's even bigger than what's out there. But
it actually spanned. It went across Pershing, where the Burger King is now. It like went across the road.
Yeah.
My interview was shot across the street from where the factory was in Derby. That's why I'm the only one standing outside like an idiot. So we went to as close to the location as we could ascertain at the time.
We were actually behind it.
But still, it was just like cool just to be. You know, just to be there. It was kind of like I worked for them, but I was living in Brooklyn and did everything through the mail. So I never got up there. And I didn't get to know, you know, like Nick Cuddy, who was the editor who bought my first stuff. He was later at DC, and I got to know him there. But, you know, I never was at the place. So it was kind of just a nice moment just to be in the vicinity. It was like, you know, just before we came in here, we passed Margot Kidder. And I was like, oh, man, I don't want to pay these people to, you know. But I went over and I said, look. Yeah, and I went over and I said, Miss Kidder, I used to write Superman and his comics for DC. And, you know, it was just I just had to come over and meet the real Lois Lane and shake her hands. And I can't tell you how fanboy-y I still am inside from having just shook hands with Margot Kidder, with Lois Lane.
So I'm not going to feel bad about accosting the Pink Power Ranger.
No. Listen, he was asking for it. He was giving you the look. You didn't know? So there's, you said it before, you know, we all gush over each other. You know, Neil was joking about Dick, of course, because Dick was one of the nicest human beings who had ever lived. And you know, if you sat down and talked to Neil, you know, one-on-one, he would be like, you know, there would probably be nobody better. You know, no better human being to him than Dick, because they were partners for years, and he was a great guy. And we do gush over each other because, you know, we're fans. That's why we're here. You know, we're fans of this stuff. We grew up, you know, the fact that I can pick up the phone and, like, you know, call Denny O'Neill, it's like, and he'll answer.
That's an awesome shot.
That's a great shot with his airbrush T-shirt.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's great to be part of this and be able to, you know, get get all that out so that people can see, you know, what this stuff meant to us.
I think we're kind of, it's bittersweet for us because, you know, we get to meet all these guys and it's great. And you know, even forming relationships, you know, when we're putting the Indiegogo campaign together, we had to reach out to see if they'd contribute something. And I write an email to Denny. And within 10 minutes, something comes back. And he's like, oh, I'd be happy to sign a bunch of books or whatever. And he's like, but if you do live appearances, I'll come and play the kazoo if it'll help. Whatever you want me to do. And I just sat there like,
holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wow. Jackie said, did you think a year ago not only would you be trading emails with Denny, but he would say something like that to you?
And
you
it's
know,
just, it's surreal. Like, I talk to Frank McLaughlin at least once a week.
Oh, I know. Poor Jackie.
He's great. He just loves to talk. But I'm just like, holy crap. Like, people would kill for this. And I'm just, like, talking to Frank about whatever.
Yeah, I've been getting texts from Bob Layton. He's in Europe. And he's just texting me. You know,
it's
blah, 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 blah.
Surreal.
Well, Charlie Kochman, who is an editor at DC and now is the head of the Abrams Art Books Division, wonderful work. Charlie said when he first got to DC, you know, you'd walk down the hall and there would be Julie Schwartz. And you'd go like, you know, and you'd be awed by Julie Schwartz, and then you'd finally, you know, say hello, and he'd say hello back to you, and you'd stop, and you'd take time, and blah, 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 and you'd talk to him, and then, you know, this keeps going on, and then after a few months, it's like, oh, God, there's Julie, I don't have time for this now, and you'd
run
go down
way.
A different way, but, you know,
right?
But you still, you know, it's still Julie, and it was still, you know, he was still the man.
I don't know how much time we get.
We've got 15 minutes.
Do we?
Yes.
Okay, because we want to make sure you guys can get questions.
Yes, I was just going to say that
in any way.
That now is the time for questions.
Or not.
Or not.
But we'll just keep going.
Well, gotcha. I guess I know you've been interviewing a lot of people. I mean, are there anybody you've been having difficulties, you know, finding? I can come up with, you know. I mean, I know a lot of them are deceased, unfortunately, but I guess.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate.
You know, try to find families or, you know, talk about parents.
I think it's probably tougher to find people, rather than the people who wrote and drew the comics, it's harder to find people who worked.
The factory workers.
Those are
in
the people.
In particular, the women who worked in the color separation department.
It's not that we're only having a hard time finding about them because these factory workers don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, we're trying to create awareness within the media locally, nationally, because these people are out there, and once they know that we're looking for them, we know that they're going to come to us. It's just creating an awareness.
And we know they're out there. Like when we went to the tag sale at this house, it was around my birthday, and John Byrne is an old friend of mine, and I called him and I said, let's go to the house. You know, let's go see what's there. And one of the things they showed on the website of the estate sale was the brass plaque that said Charlton Publications that hung outside the front door. And I showed that to John, and John said, if that's still there, that's your birthday present. And I was like, hey, yes, you know. So we get there, and somebody who worked for Charlton in the factory came in. They got it for $350. Now, whereas I was very disappointed not to get this, I was happy that it actually went to, you know, a guy who it really meant something to. But he's out there, and we'd love to find him and talk to him. You know, these are the people that are going to be hard to find. The professionals, if they're alive,
we can track them down.
Whether or not they'll talk,
they'll talk.
He'll talk. I'll make them talk. I got ways of making people talk.
You know, we're looking for some of the women, and, you know, you can't change history, and it was a very misogynistic time, and they were either the secretaries or office assistants, you'd call them now, or administrative assistants, or color separators. That's pretty much the role of the woman at Charlton Comics. You know, a lot of people go, oh, this movie's full of old guys. Well... I can't rewrite what happened just to get your PC quota, but we really, really want to find some of these women, and we have a lead on one of them who's in Florida now, and we're trying, we're so close to getting one of the San Angelos, Charlie San Angelo. It's like we go this far,
we've gone through his granddaughter, we've gone through his daughter, and it's just we're circling.
And
but
Frank
no one
keeps
can come
saying,
back.
Oh, his house, it's up on the hill. If you go down this road and you look up to the right, you'll see a white house, and that's the one.
You can see it from the highway.
Yeah. Oh. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
Appreciate that.
And this is the sun. This is Charles. Both Santangelo and Levy. Levy.
Ed Levy.
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 No. Oh, right. I was married to a woman named Levy, but they pronounced it Levy.
Yeah.
So I always get confused. Anyway. They both had sons named Charles, and that's why they named the company Charlton. So this is the son of the founder.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Who Frank co-created Judo Master with.
That's
right.
They
were in judo classes together. And so I wish Frank would just go up to that house and knock on the door for us.
Or you know, take you.
Or take us there, right? So
yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Recently, they had a good issue of Back Issue magazine that had a lot of backstory on Charlton and his real informant. I started reading comics before I could read, and I grew up in Charlton, Massachusetts. So I remember, you used to get the three comics
in a bag.
Yeah.
The Zares, the Fair, and that's where I would find Charlton comics here and there. So I was kind of had a fascination because it was my town. I was like, where is it? You know, let's find it. But really my question would be that all these kind of salty, interesting characters, when the characters were acquired by DC in the mid-80s, were these people still involved? I mean, was it still such kind of non-corporate entity? Or
the whole...
already had the character?
The legal situation, the ownership of these characters... are really a mess. It's so nebulous. They would, as you saw somebody mention in the thing, that they would, they would sell rights to different characters to different people. Other people would say, I bought those rights. One guy bought, all the romance proofs, Lustig, another guy bought this. DC got, Paul Levitz, bought them, acquired the Charlton characters essentially as a birthday present for Dick Giordano. I think he paid them something along the lines of $500 each for the rights. Mm-hmm. I think.
Action hero line.
Yeah, for the action hero
line. That's the question, Peacemaker, Judo Master,
right.
Captain Atom.
Right. Nightshade, yeah.
Right.
Peter Cannon Thunderbolt, there was some kind of nebulous thing going on. And DC eventually returned the rights to Pete Morisi, the creator. When I was, I edited the DC revival that Michael Collins wrote and drew, and I sent Pete copies when we had the proofs. And fortunately, he liked what we were doing, and I even got to have lunch with him once with. Dick Giordano took Pete and I to the Society of Illustrators in Manhattan, and so I got to have a lunch with Pete Morisi and listen to him, because he's a fascinating guy. He was he started out as an artist when in the early 50s there was a big fall off in comics production. Companies were going out right and left, and Pete, seeing the writing on the wall, did what any Irishman in New York would do. He became a cop, and he's Italian.
Yeah, he's a cop.
A lot of Italian cops in New York, though.
Yeah.
So he was a police officer, but he continued writing comics, drawing comics, but that's why he used the PAM, the Pam pseudonym, because it was they weren't allowed to moonlight, so he could have lost his job as a cop if they had known he was drawing comics on the side. But, great guy, big jovial guy, he was a beat cop and a...
No, Dynamite Comics.
Dynamite...
Bought
his Johnny Danger.
Okay.
Yeah, he created a private eye character named Johnny Danger,
I think.
They
did a series with the Peacemaker, too, and they did the Shadow series recently,
2005,
something like that.
Yeah, yeah, they acquire
all those. Who knows? But that's the thing in... We've even found out they weren't renewing copyrights on these characters. They no longer own them, and they were still selling
them. Right.
Like, the Blue Beetle, the Golden Age Dan Garrett Blue Beetle is public domain.
Mm-hmm.
But the, what's his name?
Ted Kord.
The Ted Kord
is
licensed by DC and copyrighted by DC. Mm-hmm. So, in theory, you can do a Ted Kord comic, they might bust your nuts for, you know, for using the Blue Beetle. But if you called it the Dan Garrett.
Dan Garrett.
It's free reign.
Yeah. So
it's interesting because I think that they featured that character on like the Batman Brave and the Bold.
Justice League Unlimited has the Question on it a lot, and Captain Atom's on it a lot.
On the animated.
Yeah.
Stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I guess the legend goes, and if we can actually get overseas for this and get either Dave Gibbons or Alan Moore or both to talk about the Watchmen thing, rumor has it that, you know, Alan was going to write that story using those Charlton characters, and Dick was like, well, don't do that to my characters.
No, don't.
You know what? Make knockoffs and do whatever you want and leave these alone.
Leave them pure.
So that's why now you have them existing in, right, you know,
as separate entities.
Separate entities, which is, thank God for that move.
And the Question was a Dick Coe creation.
Yes, he was.
Pure?
Was he involved in the Inception? Because I know when it came to DC, he wrote...
That, if...
I think Denny inherited it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Denny is... Steve's version of Question and Denny's version of Question, if you read them side by side, you will find a very different politic, political thing going on. Because, you know, Steve is a determinist and you know, Denny's just an old hippie. So,
worlds colliding.
Yeah.
And now for reprint, like paperback reprint, is there a lot out there yet for Charlton? The Masterworks kind of.
Other than the Masterworks, really nothing. No.
There are
nope.
Masterworks.
There were two. DC did two archives, two hardcover archives, reprinting most of the Ditko stuff. They did the Captain Atom stuff. They did Blue Beetle.
Question.
They did Question.
Basically, the stuff they bought.
Yeah, bits of
Judo Master.
So, yeah, but there's still a lot that.
And we're finding when we go try to, you know, we try to buy some issues to use as B-roll or what have you, and they're holding value. They're not cheap.
Quite well.
I just looked through a box, and it's like, you know, I used to pick up old Charltons for, you know, a couple of bucks.
$0.50,
a couple of bucks maybe. And now they're $17, $18, $25. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
There definitely does seem to be an increased awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it's their time. You know, everybody's collected everything else. You know, they've collected Marvel, they've collected DC. What's left? Oh, Charlton.
Yeah, yeah, it's retro. It's undiscovered material.
Yeah.
Like, we found a 15-year-old fan who was tired of Marvel and DC, and he wanted something more, so he started going to flea markets and shows, and he found Charlton. He's 15, and he's got quite the collection. So yeah. It's...
And Charlton published, by the way, just... During the course of their comic publishing time, they produced maybe 6,300 titles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was
gonna say
6,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know the what's cool with this, as we've been at it about a calendar year. It was late November when we shot Paul and Bob Layton for the first two trailer bits, and we've done well in the comic book culture. Comic book. People are excited and aware of it, and it's gaining a lot of momentum. We're hitting our ceiling, our head on the ceiling, trying to get into the pop culture sphere now. So that's the big challenge for this upcoming year, because if we can get that kind of mass exposure, we'll be off and running, and then it's reflecting in the Indiegogo campaign, I think. I think the hardcore comic fans are aboard, and then we just can't get that next level. And how do you entice? It's a documentary. It's not a Captain America thing. Yeah.
Yeah, we're really trying to push that issue.
Yeah. Well, that'll blow the lid off. Because nobody will care about the Charlton movie anymore. They'll just be like, how'd you get Ditko?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
that's
no,
all I want to hear.
Yeah. No,
how'd you get him?
We get, you know, you get Ditko, you tell
you
Jonathan Ross to go bite me, and then you just...
Yeah.
The only reason why we're not going to release the Steve Ditko information yet is because...
We'll scare him away.
We don't want to scare him. And so this is going to be, once I receive the letter back and hear what his ideas are, then maybe we can say, we got Steve Ditko.
And on that note, on that hopeful note, thank you. This was a lot of
fun.
And appreciate
your
interest.
Please, you know, continue to spread the word. Take postcards. These are no good in a week, so take them. And give them to your friends, family, leave them at the library, put them in supermarkets, put them in bike spokes, whatever works.
Yeah. Big dog shots.